welcome to the Hopkins Green Tea Energy Podcast by Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. My name is Leonie Hikita. Today I'm joining with my co-host,
Shada Hushmandi,
Abigail Hunter,
Amethyst Devlin.
We are so excited to bring our second episode of the Hopkins Green Teas. So today we are going to talk about Inflation Reduction Act, IRA, which is the key energy policy in the States, also the single largest investment in clean climate and energy in American histories, and such a turbocharge to the green economy. Before jumping in today's topic, it's end of the year, so why don't we look back our 2022 a little bit, what happened in the world, also in our lives in this year?
That is a great idea. I think one of the most important events of the year that we can sort of analyze anything in relation to that is the invasion of Ukraine, which sent the prices of oil and gas soaring. We all know that crude exports is Russia's most important revenue, and it feels almost like half of the budget for Kremlin. US, EU and their allies chose to target that income specifically and responded with sanctions as well as freezing Russian reserves, the central bank's reserves. They have not managed to stop the war, obviously, with the sanctions, but have damaged the Russian economy to some extent. Some of their measures, though, contributed to the price rise. For example, the price cap, which has been recently set, is believed to have contributed to the gas price rise. The cap decision was controversial to begin with, and it's been criticized by the economists. While OPEC Plus has said that they're going to keep their output basically limit as it was, the cap on the price of Russian oil is believed to disrupt global supplies in the months to come in this winter. But US and Europe has been so far really lucky because the autumn was quite mild. Although US was lucky, but EU wasn't that lucky because they had to pay a big price for filling their reserves, specifically and particularly buying from the US. And in the US, since our topic is about the IRA, I think it's good to look at whether IRA is going to help with the soaring prices or not. I think it's still a question mark and we don't know the answer, but there are basically two opinions about it. US oil and gas companies are skeptical and say tax increases will hurt the industry. The ones who are in support of the IRA, they insist that it fights the inflation and sends signal for more economic activities, and that would increase the oil and gas production, while it also increases IRA increases the investment in clean energy technologies as well. And they say it could offer more offshore and onshore leasing and CCUS opportunities within the sector, which ultimately benefit the sector itself, the oil and gas sector.
So you covered masterfully the inflation side of this. So that was what I was going to mention. I think this year might be a little bit known for inflation. The one thing that I'll add to the energy price increase that we experienced in the past year was an acute increase in the price of cars as a result, and particularly used cars, which usually can be, you know, a little bit more affordable for people as a result of the semiconductor shortage. So I think that everybody on the Hill and maybe a lot of people in DC have become experts on chips and semiconductors in the past year, just because one small vulnerability in our supply chain, one component of a full car built of many components, not having access to that has created major headaches for a lot of Americans. So I think that that's another, maybe an example of how inflation has played out beyond the energy stuff. I know that, you know, there's other impacts to inflation as well, like groceries. A friend of mine was planning her wedding and she was terrified. The price of flowers went up astronomically. So, you know, there's been major economic ramifications across the U.S. and the world, I don't think Americans necessarily realize, but because we've had a lot of economic response to this, we haven't necessarily felt the impacts as much as other countries. You know, there's increases as up to 1,100% in countries like Venezuela on inflation. So I do think that some of the economic signals that the legislation we've passed, the U.S. has passed recently, and one of which we'll talk about today, does send an incredible, you know, economic signal in a way that can potentially prevent the larger increase in prices across the board. So that's my hot take on the inflation side of things that has been buzzing around this year.
Yeah, a lot of this is coming from our increase in, and we're seeing the impacts of climate change, and, you know, we're really feeling, a lot of these countries are feeling the impact and the pressure to follow through with the commitments that they've made, fund the commitments that they've made. And, you know, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released their sixth report in 2021, but they released the third part of that report in 2022. And I think that getting that on the desks of a lot of different people was really important to pushing forward, you know, what our scientists are saying, and that we are, you know, just on the brink. We're very, very shy of making... we're not going to be able to come back from what we've done. And we, you know, they are saying we are going to exceed 1.5 degrees Celsius warming. And they're saying that by, you know, 2040 now. So I think that there's a lot of increased pressure. And the more that we get like this scientific community and give them the platform to be able to get this out to everybody, you know, I have a lot of friends that work in climate change. I have a lot of friends who don't work in climate change, and everybody was talking about this report because it's something that's made public. And I think that it just goes to show that people are paying attention to this, and they're consuming this science and this material and the marketing material. And I think 2022 is really big for just discussions on climate change and action on climate change. And it's leading for a good 2023. I'm excited.
Yeah, we should include that report in our post so folks can find it. If you haven't read it, I think that would be helpful.
Yeah, absolutely.
So 2022 was a pretty tough year in matter of economics, diplomacy, energy supply, and environment. So Inflation Reduction Act is also trying to address these matters. This legislation is really a big impact and also a lot of content, so we cannot cover everything. But yeah, let me share the four features of IRA. So the first one is a differentiation with IIJA, which is Infrastructure Investment Job Act of 2021. And the second is a methane emission price. And third feature is a technology neutral. And the last one is energy security. So the first one are the differentiations between Infrastructure Investment Job Act of 2021 and Inflation Reduction Act. So people might get confused, like infra or something, blah, blah, blah. So, but these regulation, they both are pushing clean energy policy. So very important one. Let's make very simple, and we can see the differences between these two registration in three aspects. One is a target, and two is a method. In DC world, we say policy instrument, and the third is economical effect. So IIJA, so their target is infrastructure, like modernizing our road, bridge, airport, including our electricity infra, EV station, smart grid, yeah, something like that. And policy instrument is a direct investment. So like a government invests a certain project. And economic effect is a job creation. Versus IRA, is the target is our life and Americans' family. And the political instrument is tax credit, like a production tax credit, investment tax credit. And economic effect is inflation relief. These are kind of big difference between two legislation. And which one is more important? I think IRA has more impact to our lives and businesses. And also they have incentives for American families to decarbonize their homes, converting for conversion to heat pumps, of also installation of rooftop solar.
This is the first futures.
And second one is the emission pricing on methane. This is actually the first emission pricing system in the States. Mm. America doesn't have any nationwide carbon pricing system. So IRA imposed a charge on excess methane emission from designated petroleum and natural gas facilities. So methane, CH4, is the main component of natural gas and potent greenhouse gas. So this emission pricing plays a significant role in climate change. This is a big punch to the U.S. energy sectors as well as economic, because the United States is the top producing country of natural gas in the world. Yeah. The third point, third future, is technology neutral. The expansion of all zero carbon energy sources or technology without preferring any one over another. So to be simplified, IRA adopted tax credit as long as clear the carbon emission criteria that are defined for each energy carrier. For example, the IRA subsidized clean hydrogen. The definition of clean is less than 2 kilograms of CO2 emission per kilogram of hydrogen production at the site of production.
Can I just add on the inclusivity of the tax credits? I really think that can't be overstated, that there's this recognition we can't pick any clean energy solution winner because we need so many options to make this viable when it comes to balancing these renewable energies, because the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always shine. We need some type of balance here. So the fact that you have some incentives for biofuels, incentives for hydrogen and different versions of hydrogen that help us get to a decreased amount of emissions in really hard industries that emit a lot because they just need a specific type of energy is really important. And this bill does that masterfully in terms of being inclusive. If you talk to any industry-specific people, they'll tell you that they feel left out or that it didn't get enough and it should be all biofuels or all hydrogen or something like that. But I do think that that's important, stressing the breadth and the inclusivity for the tax credits. Because before, the production tax credit and the investment tax credit were specific to specific types of renewable energies, and now it's widened. So I think that says a lot.
So the last one is energy security. So far in the principle of Democrats, they have adhere to the basic policy of promoting green energy, and they hate promoting fossil fuel. But however, the energy security element was added to the promote measures related to fossil fuel, such as implementation of oil and gas leasing on federal lands and waters, and amendment of betting rule of mining areas. So this legislation will widely affect in multiple fields on the top of energy sectors. Right, Abigail, do you want to share with us the overview and background of the legislation?
Yeah, happily. And I think, you know, I spoke about inflation and Shada mentioned inflation at the top too. So maybe it's appropriate that we delve in with the name first and then switch to the political context that enabled it to be passed. But so it was called the Inflation Reduction Act, maybe because of the moment that it was passed, for some political branding to justify the immense amount of spending that went into it following incredible amounts of spending in the infrastructure package and the last of the several COVID spending packages that was passed under the Biden-Harris administration. And so luckily for us, we don't have to debate its effects on inflation and on the economy at large. We just get to talk about how it fights climate change and how it enables sustainable energy to thrive.
May I just add something?
Please.
In support of the IRA, I think it really brought back that climate credibility to the U.S. that was sort of, you know, I don't want to use a strong word of shattered, but during the Trump's time, you know, coming out of the Paris Agreement. So I think that's a huge achievement.
Even though we had major justification with an administration change and a Democratic majority in Congress to make that shift following the Trump administration, who removed themselves from the Paris Climate Accords, which was the multilateral kind of framework that enabled governments to come together against climate change. Even though we had that context, this was still an extremely bumpy road. So the bill itself presents incredible investments in both the supply side and demand side for clean energy and electrification. And also it helps abate industrial emissions. So for example, when you have to heat something at a really high temperature in order to make it into the end substance that's used in everyday life, for example. What I mean from the supply side in terms of what it helps is it puts a lot of money into building up the manufacturing of these clean technologies in the US. There's a lot of domestic incentives here. And it makes it more affordable to build them because you have further incentives that when you are putting the money in to build a wind farm or install solar, there's incentives to that as well. And the reason that these renewable energies aren't more prevalent today, even though we've seen without subsidies that they've actually been able to decrease cost, is because that the upfront cost to building them is very, very expensive. So this bill helps alleviate that cost, decrease it, and makes them more competitive with fossil fuels, so thus helping us transition. On the demand side, there's a lot of money incentivizing the use of the clean technologies. So if you want an electric car and are from a middle-income household, lower-income household, there's now a $7,500 tax credit for you to get a new electric vehicle or a $4,000 tax credit for you to get an old one. And that's money back in your pocket when you make those purchases without necessarily undercutting the competitiveness of that company that's producing them. The government is helping, you know, create more of a demand for it so that ultimately when these things go away, you know, you'll have higher market penetration for EVs or used EVs. And it's not just EVs. These tax credits, you know, exist for heat pumps in your homes. They exist for solar panels, home charging stations to plug in that car. Overall, the Rhodium Group found that the IRA will save households an average of about $1,025 per year every year through 2030. So it does have direct impacts on many people. I did want to talk, like I talked about or alluded to before, about the context in which the Inflation Reduction Act was passed, because like I said, it wasn't just immediate. I can't overstate how many people thought this bill wouldn't happen, and I'm not just saying that to cover my own bum, because I kept on telling people in my work life that this bill wouldn't pass, and then they all called me when it did and said, you said this wouldn't happen. I was like, okay, I'm sorry I read the green tea leaves incorrectly. It kind of was like a zombie apocalypse. It kept on dying. The bill kept dying. And then just when you thought it was gone, you get a jump scare out of nowhere that it was back and resurrected and alive. And the reason for that volatility is because the Congress that passed this bill had the smallest majority out of any Congress in history collectively. So you need 218 votes to pass a bill in the House. But you need a simple majority, so you just need, if you're the party that's in the majority, which Democrats were at that time, led by Nancy Pelosi, that's enough if you can caucus together and get those votes. In the Senate side, you typically need 60 votes to pass a bill. Democrats came into power in 2021, following the 2020 elections, with 50 votes. So split 50-50, and the vice president becomes the tiebreaker in that situation. So the votes and the bills that can pass with a 50-50 vote go to the party that has the vice president, which in this case was also the Democrats. So the only way you can kind of sneak in these simple majority votes on the Senate side and bypass what's called the filibuster that requires the 60-vote threshold is if you use something called budget reconciliation. So the bill really only has to do with revenues and taxes. And so that's why this bill has such a heavy footprint in terms of incentives versus just new policymaking and spending, which they aren't able to use this type of bill to pass. So all the pressure essentially went on one person to pass this bill because it took 50 votes and there was one conservative Democrat that held on to that authority, I would say a little heavily. And so most of the spotlight went to Joe Manchin, the conservative Democrat from West Virginia, which is a coal-producing state in terms of passing this legislation. while all the kudos in the world should go to him and his staff for, and also other staff on the Hill for passing this, I think the political moment Shada mentioned with regards to what's happening in Europe made sure the United States did not take energy security for granted.
Yeah.
Renewable energy sources, for context, are somewhat shielded from the volatility of market prices of energy. And that's why it's so important that we have more access to renewable energy so that we aren't necessarily subject to that volatility. That at the same time, just having renewable energies isn't enough. You need a real plethora and an incentive to move us away from what is really a bought-in system in fossil fuels in the United States, and you need to have ability to access them. So this bill did just that. It really included a wide breadth of policies that enabled a much higher penetration of renewable energies to the U.S. It recognized that this type of energy dependence on other countries for fossil fuels is not going to be effective in terms of our ability to ensure that everybody continues to use energy at the rate that we are in this country. It also recognizes that we can't transition an energy reliance from fossil fuels to an energy in the Middle East or in Russia, for the case of Europe, to a reliance on minerals and batteries processed and manufactured in China to have storage. So with that in mind, I just want to mention that, that's kind of really, I think, what put Joe Manchin and other Democrats, Senator Joe Manchin and other Democrats, over the edge in terms of passing this piece of legislation. And so it's not without the political headwinds that things happen in D.C. It's really capitalizing on big moments that push people over the edge. I think we covered all of the main topics. So hearing from Amethyst on, I think, another big underlying aspect of this bill, which is the overlay of environmental justice or consciousness of lower income communities that are affected by climate change and affected by emissions the most.
One of the really great things is that about the IRA is that they have mobilized a lot of funding and put it into environmental justice and really getting communities mobilized by giving them the capital that they need. And I think that, like, just to take a step back, it's really important to recognize that when the Biden administration came in, they, you know, they signed this commitment that was called the Justice 40 Initiative, and it essentially was a promise that any of the federal funding that they mobilize for climate change, for clean energy, for transportation, for a lot of different things, that 40% of that was the commitment that they were making was going to go towards environmental justice efforts. And so we're kind of seeing that now really come into play as we're looking at these large bills and the money that we're able to mobilize and put out into communities. And the really important aspect about them is that they're putting money into the hands of, like, the community-led groups, but through grant programs and other funding. And that's where it's really going to be. That's the work that's being done because they see the impacts, right? Like, those are the community groups who are being impacted by pollution from fossil fuel industries, and now they're able to get, like, funding for sensors on fence lines so that they can make sure that they're not being overpolluted. And they're getting a lot extra money for when we're putting, like, renewable energy projects and solar projects on federally subsidized low-income housing or other marginalized disadvantaged communities. And so I think that it's really important to, you know, stand by, like, this money is not just going to what historically we've done is given this type of federal funding to affluent homes who already would have been able to afford putting solar on their roof. But now it made it, like, economically pretty. So we saw a huge market penetration because we put that financing behind this solar technology, but the groups that couldn't afford it in the first place still couldn't afford it. And so it's really important to see that transition where they're committing to spending money. And we're seeing this in not just the IRA, but also in NEVI, which is the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Plan, and where they're favoring Justice 40 communities is what they're calling them. And so this is going to be really important as we see, like, this capital mobilized to combat climate change, especially for tribal communities, low-income communities, any type of disadvantage, you know, historically redlined communities. It's really going to be super impactful. And I think, too, like, IRA beyond the United States is going to have so many impacts on these types of communities that are feeling the impacts on climate change. And that's definitely Shada's wheelhouse. So kind of what are your perspectives on that?
Yeah, sure. Before that, I'd like to maybe ask a question about the environmental justice point of view. So basically, tax credits always comes with this criticism that it favors basically higher income classes. And with the EV tax credit, are we helping the lower income people as well?
Yeah, so originally, when the original version of the IRA was passed in the House in 2021, I think it did not include an income level contingency. And that was a big sticking point for conservative Democrats and some Republicans who were engaged in the conversation behind the scenes, that this is putting money in the hands of wealthy people that would probably buy the EV anyway.
Yep.
And can afford an accountant to help them figure out how to get the tax return, which I think is another big thing that makes challenges here. You have to make sure that you're actually like putting these into your tax returns to access the return on your personal investment. But this bill puts a cap. You have to, I don't remember the exact threshold, but you cannot be making a certain amount of money as an individual or as a household, which targets, which is why I said, I think at the beginning, it's middle income and lower income that are be able to access these tax credits. And that I think is great because it narrows the scope for people that would need the car and then, you know, not necessarily be able to afford it anyway. But it doesn't necessarily, we still need to figure out how we're going to scheme out plugging in these vehicles and the cost affiliated with that as well. And I think that that's, you know, the NEVI system and how we go through that process is equally as important in that regard. But yes, to answer your question, there is income thresholds for accessibility of the EV or the clean vehicle tax credit in the bill.
Great. When I was like looking at the IRA, I couldn't find anything about the public transport, but that's something that we can probably talk about in the next session. So moving to your question about the developing countries or non-OECD countries, it will help emerging economies by reducing the cost of clean energy technologies and spillover effects because it lowers the cost of production for these technologies. Over the past decade, mainly it was China and Europe that sort of driven this prices going down by investing and producing more and more. Now the IRA could increase the US supply and demand for clean energy and push the prices even further down. I think it's a good news for the growing economies because it means they could afford to invest more in solar, wind, and any clean energy technologies. And it would also change the dynamic of the US-China competition by helping the clean energy industry in the US, in a sense, so it's good for the US as well. This is a great move, as I mentioned, for the climate credibility of the US. And the only issue is that the IRA does not solve the problem of climate financing in the non-OECD countries.
Yeah, which I don't know if there's the political will in the US right now to deal with those questions. Everyone has turned very inward following previously before the pandemic, but especially in the pandemic. So I'm pessimistic about any potential to add those things in
there.
Yeah,
but you didn't think the IRA was going to pass
either.
Yeah,
exactly. I have lost all credibility. Hey, but the U.S., as Shada just said, the U.S. came back credible to the climate arena finally and stopped being hypocrites for a little bit and actually did something domestically. So, hey, maybe there's hope for me.
So one thing that we mentioned in our first episode is a segment that we wanted to do, which is dumb questions. So we have our first question. You know, when I'm plugging in my holiday lights for my tree or around my home, you know, what is the more environmentally sound decision? Do I plug these into a wall outlet in my home or do I get a battery pack for these so that they're not running on the grid? And I think that Abigail is the perfect person to answer this question.
We chatted a little bit back and forth on this, and the question really stems from what's the energy that is on your grid? It's a very regional or local specific question, which is why a level of awareness on your electricity bill, if you have the time to to look into that, I think, is helpful when you're making these decisions. So if you are plugging in your Christmas lights, your holiday lights, anything of that nature, and you want to make the least emitting decision, it depends on what the grid is. So in this person's case, she was plugging into a grid that is fueled by nuclear and hydropower. So that's better. It's lower emitting than if you were to have a battery pack that's using minerals and processing to create the batteries that aren't necessarily always recycled in the right way. I know I have a drawer of batteries at home that I'm like, I need to recycle these properly, but who knows what that means. So, you know, if that's the case, if you're plugging into an outlet that's fueled by fossil fuels, natural gas to a lesser degree, but certainly oil, if that's kind of where you're getting your energy from for your home, then I would suggest picking the battery option. But again, it ends up being quite regional, which is, I think, certainly a takeaway we've learned from our degree program, is it really matters where you are and what's fueling your life based on what's possible, whether you have high solar irradiation, or if you have hydropower in your backyard, or if you are from a coal community. That makes a big difference. So thank you for our listener's first question.
And submit any more questions on our Twitter page or on our LinkedIn, and we are going to reach out to you and ask you some more questions and then bring it on our next episode.
Yes. So we really hope you enjoy today's episode and understand what ILA is in the big picture. You will be excited to the next episode also. The next episode, you will be able to understand how these incentives works in the actual world, especially promoting solar energy industry. Until that, we hope you have fun in Christmas holiday and see the wonderful new year 2023. We are the Hopkins Green Tea from Johns Hopkins. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast. Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays.
I have a New Year's resolution for you. It's listen to us in 2023.